This is Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Writers on a New England Stage brings acclaimed authors to the Granite State to discuss their lives and recent works. And in this episode, NHPR's Director of On-Demand Audio, Rebecca Lavoie, spoke at length with author Ariel Lawhon about her latest work, The Frozen River. Ariel's latest, The Frozen River, is a thrilling, tense, and tender story about a remarkable woman who left an unparalleled legacy yet remains nearly forgotten to this day. Ariel Lawhon is a critically acclaimed New York Times bestselling author of historical fiction. Her books have been translated into numerous languages and have been Indie Next, Costco, Amazon Spotlight, and Book of the Month Club selections. This conversation was recorded before a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on November 6, 2024.
I am so glad that you're all here joining us for this conversation. Thank you for coming out for it. It feels like a really good time to curl up with a good book and talk about it. And thank you so much for joining us, Ariel.
Thank you so much for having me here. I am delighted. This is my first time here.
Really?
Yes, first time.
So, The Frozen River tells the fictionalized story of a real-life person, 18th century midwife Martha Ballard. How did you learn about Martha Ballard?
So Martha Ballard, if you're not familiar with her, there are three things you need to know. She was a midwife in the 1700s who delivered over 1,000 babies in the course of her career, and she never lost a mother in childbirth. The second thing you need to know about her is that she kept a diary for over 30 years at a time when most women could not read or write. And the third thing that I find fascinating is that she was the great aunt of Clara Barton, founder of the American Red Cross, and she was the great great grandmother of Mary Hobart, who was one of the first female physicians in the United States. And I knew none of this until August 8th, 2008. And the
specific
date. I was pregnant with our fourth child. My husband and I had four kids in 5 years. I take that back. We did not have them. I had them. And I was pregnant with number four, and I had gone to a routine doctor's visit on August 8th, 2008, and my doctor was late for the appointment. So I'd been stranded in his waiting room, and I had two options. I could reschedule and go home, but there were children there. And I didn't miss them currently. And my husband had them, so probably nobody was going to die. The other option was I could stick it out and wait for my doctor to show up. And so I chose the latter. And I was in his waiting room for hours, the entire afternoon. And I finished the book that I brought with me. And then I read all of the magazines in the office. And there was nothing left except for that pile of scary pamphlets they have in the corner that you don't want to read because you don't want to know how you're going to die. As I was flipping through those pamphlets, and underneath I found a small devotional called Our Daily Bread, really common in doctor's offices in Texas at the time. So I flipped open this devotional, and to August 8th, 2008, I still have the page, which is why it's memorable. And I proceeded to read the story of a woman named Martha Ballard, who had delivered over 1,000 babies in her career and never lost a mother in childbirth. And I remember sitting there thinking, the doctor that I'm waiting on cannot boast a record like that. But Martha Ballard did it in the 1700s without the benefit of cesarean section or modern medicine. And I just remember thinking, that would make a great novel. So I ripped the page out and I put it in my purse. It is worth noting here because I got hate mail recently for ripping the page. I'm like, oh, come on. It's a disposable, like, it's 3 months. You're meant to chuck it in the trash after the 3 months. I did not desecrate a leather-bound hardcover book.
It's like desecrating Us Weekly in a doctor's office, yes. Right? It's fine. So, it'll be fine.
But I kid you not, 2 minutes later, my doctor walked in. And I think about that sometimes when I'll turn around, I look at my bookshelf, and I see The Frozen River there. I think, if I had gone home and rescheduled, this book would not exist.
Hmm. So I listened to your author's note for the book. In it, you describe yourself as a collector of people.
Yes.
And you also say that this book is different than the other ones you've written because they could be described as biographical fiction, but this one can't. So can you talk about that?
I love people. I love collecting their stories. My favorite thing is to stumble across somebody or a moment in time or a person that I'm vaguely familiar with, but I don't know the specifics, and then to do a deep dive into their world. The difference with this particular book is that unlike my other four, there was so little research material available. We have Martha Ballard's diary, and we have a biography called A Midwife's Tale by Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, which, go buy it. It's amazing. It won a Pulitzer. It is the definitive history of Martha's life. We have those two things. Her diary is this really intimate day-to-day look at the life of a woman in the 1700s. And then the biography is this 30,000-foot view of the overarching life and times. But I was writing one story set during 6 months of her life, and there was so little to go on. Unlike many of my other novels, there were no conversations recorded. There were no specifics about her relationships and her friendships. It had to be created out of whole cloth. And so in that sense, this is the most fictional of my stories, even though the vast majority of what happens in the book is real.
Can you describe the way that Martha wrote her diaries? Because I think it's fascinating. They're not written like prose style. So you, I think, had to imagine, you know, the details around them, but also rethink the way she could have written them so that we could read them in your book. But how are they actually written?
We call it a diary. It's really not. It's not even a journal. Are you familiar with a day book? My grandmother kept a day book. That's more of what it is. She will give you the date. She will give you the weather. Oftentimes, she'll tell you what she cooked for dinner, whose baby she delivered, who came to visit. It is very truncated, very specific. There is little to no editorializing in the 900 pages of her diary that we have left. If you were to read her diary, which you probably won't, because I will be honest, it's rough sledding.
It's expensive.
My copy cost $350. It was a good investment. I think it paid off. So you're not going to read it. But if you did, there is one phrase that you would find repeated thousands of times. She'll give you the date. She'll give you the weather. She made chicken. She delivered a baby. Her friend came to visit. And she will end the diary entry with this one phrase. And she will say, "I have been at home." And it was sort of this mantra that happened throughout her diary. But for me, I wrote this book during COVID. And every day, I would go to my desk, I would open the document, I would open my research material, things I needed to do, the notebook of what scenes I was going to write that day, and then I would open her diary and I would read several passages. And she did this, and she did this. I have been at home. So my mantra became, me too, Martha. Also, yes, I have been at home for days and days and weeks and months and years. And when I think back to that girl in the doctor's office, pregnant with three other really little kids at home, I think that girl could not have written this book as it exists now. But also, I needed to write this book during that very specific time. It gave me this affinity for Martha Ballard because her entire life, her work and her home life, was one piece. There was no separation. She was at home with all of her children, with her husband constantly. And I feel as though I understood her in a way that I would not have been able to understand her had I written it at any other time.
So the novel opens with a dead body in an ice-bound New England river. And Martha is a midwife, but she also becomes a detective in your book. How did you decide to do that construct? And are you a mystery writer now?
I've always been a mystery writer. I love a good old-fashioned whodunit. I love them. I have not written a whodunit since my very first novel, but I grew up reading Agatha Christie. It's fun for me. And when I was trying to decide what I would write next, it's always the question, what will I write next? I was like, I don't know what the subject matter will be, but I know I want to do a murder mystery. And so I went into it specifically knowing I want to do a murder mystery. And how fun would that be to have a midwife detective? We don't get those very often.
But aren't midwives perfectly suited to be detectives in a way? Because as we learn in the book, she's a collector and keeper of secrets, right? Yes.
So she's in your home. She is delivering your baby. But what we don't realize about midwives is that they were much, much more than the person who delivered your baby. If you got cut or burned, you called the midwife and they would give you stitches and they would come make a tonic, make a salve. They were your primary care providers. They were your pharmacist. They were your general practitioner in most communities at the time, because in the 1780s, in the wilds of what was then the District of Maine in the state of Massachusetts, many towns did not have their own physician. So if something goes wrong, you quite literally call for the midwife. But she was also the coroner. Somebody dies, they call her to inspect the body to see if she can try and determine cause of death for any potential legal proceedings that happen. And so, yes, the book begins with a body. The first line in the book is the body floats downstream. And then it gets locked in the river when it freezes, which, for the record, I am from the Southwest and I did not know that could happen.
Welcome to New Hampshire.
Yes. They find the body, extract it from the river. They call Martha Ballard. She inspects the body, comes to a conclusion, and immediately is interrupted by the new town doctor, who has a very different idea of what happened. And then we are off to the races.
I'd love you to talk a little bit more about that, because the doctor character in your book is new to town. He can't not say that he was trained at Harvard, like every other sentence. But what were doctors doing at this time? Like, how did they differ from what the midwives were providing?
So it's a really, really interesting point in American history and also medical history, because we have this newly formed Harvard University. We have some of the first classes to graduate, their first medical students, all men, and they are going out into these communities to doctor, to treat these patients. But it was about that same time that the medical community, that was entirely male, looked at labor and delivery as a source of lost income. So modern obstetrics really began in a way that doctors were going, oh, that is medical. I should be treating it. Mm. I should be delivering these babies. I have studied anatomy in a textbook. I can do this. Many times what happened, however, is that they did not bother to learn from the women who'd been doing this for decades and decades and had thousands of years worth of knowledge passed down one to another. So when this doctor shows up in this town, his name is Dr. Benjamin Page, it sets up this conflict between midwifery and obstetrics. But it was a real conflict that happened in Martha Ballard's world, because you have a 24-year-old boy showing up with a degree and lots of book knowledge and no experiential knowledge, and he begins to encroach upon Martha's territory with really deadly results. And all of the births and the situations and things that go wrong in the book really happened, and they are recorded in her diary. And it was this really fascinating rivalry is the wrong word. It was just this conflict between these two ways of treating women in labor.
I'm curious how many people in this book were based on real people. Was it all of them, most of them?
The vast majority. There might be one or two that are composite characters. And then there were plenty that I had to strip out. There's a lot of people in this book. It is a very heavy populated village. And so I had to be judicious in who got time on the page and who fit into the specific story that I was trying to tell.
One of the funniest details in your author's note is you talk about how many of the women in the village were named Hannah. So you actually changed the name of some of those women.
Everybody's a Hannah. Lots of Hannahs, lots of Rebeccas. And then you get lots of really archaic biblical names. Like, her husband is Ephraim, which took me half the book before I realized how that was pronounced. So it's kind of fun. You get to use some names that you don't typically find in a novel.
How is Ephraim, her husband, represented in her writing? Because in the book, he manifests as this incredibly feminist, incredibly supportive man in 1789, feels very much like the ideal partner today. So how much did you know about him when you were writing about him?
We know basic facts. We know that they were married for the entirety of their lives. We know that they had 9 children, 6 of whom are living at the time the story opens. We know that they were business partners. They ran a mill together. They worked together. We know that at the very least, he was supportive of her career. She had a lifelong thriving medical career as a midwife. It is not a stretch for me to believe that that translated into the rest of their life and their family. Ephraim Ballard, it is important to note, the version in this book resembles my own husband greatly. So that's my influence. That's his, right? His mother did a good job. He's actually home. I'm here because he is home with our 2 sick teenage boys, making them soup and taking them to the doctor. Good men have existed for all of history. And that is one thing that I think is very easy to forget. My personal pet peeve in fiction is that we so rarely get to see good men, and we so rarely get to see good marriages in particular. And as a novelist, I know why. It is easier to write the bad marriage because all of the conflict exists right there. If you write a good marriage, the conflict has to come from elsewhere. But when I sat down to tell this story, knowing that Martha was remarkable, knowing that she must have had support in her home, I wanted to tell the story of a good marriage.
Something else that's somewhat rare is a novel where the protagonist is a woman in her mid-50s. What was that choice? Because you had 27 years of her life to choose from. So why did you make that choice?
Again, another pet peeve. But also bred from life experience. Like I said, the girl in the doctor's office could not have written Martha Ballard, who is 54 years old when the novel opens. It's the first novel idea I came up with. It is not the first I've written. It's the 5th. And I kept going back to it and thinking, is it time? Is it time? I'd pull out that piece of paper that I stole. and I go, not yet. Not yet. And I used to think it's because it's a hard novel to write. It's a hard novel to pull off. I have since realized I just wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. I needed more life experience under my belt. A major theme in this novel is about having grown children, having kids grow up and leave you. And who are you as a person when the primary work that you have done for decades is now over? And I had finally reached that point in my life. But also, not being young myself, I find that I want to see more mature women on the page.
You're listening to a conversation between NHPR's Rebecca Lavoie and Ariel Lahan, author of The Frozen River. We'll be right back in a moment with more of their conversation on Writers on a New England Stage. Welcome back to Writers on a New England Stage. This conversation between NHPR's Rebecca Lavoie and author Ariel Lahan was recorded on November 6, 2024, in front of a live audience.
Hallowell, Maine is where the book is set, but Hallowell also, to me, became a character in the story. You're not from New England. No. How did you pull that off?
Tomorrow will be my first time to Maine in my entire life.
Amazing.
So my original plan was to go to Maine to research the book when I was writing, because I have 900 children. And I had them so close together. Research trips were just impossible for much of my career. But I was like, I can do it. I can get to Maine. I'm going to go research this woman in person. And COVID happened. And we were all stuck at home. And listen, had I known COVID was coming, I would not have suggested to my husband that we buy a drum set for our youngest son for Christmas, December 2019. Alas, the book was written to the sound of 1,000 drums over my head. But COVID ruined that opportunity completely, and so I was stuck doing this the way that I always have been, which is my research material, my imagination, Google Maps, lots of pictures, and then a recreation that is my version of a place, my version of an event, my version of what could have happened. But all towns are the same, really. People are the same. That is one thing you learn when you have my job, is that people have been peopling since the dawn of time.
You may or may not have intended it, but this novel speaks very much to many elements of where we are today. Except in many ways, things seemed not necessarily easier for women, certainly, but simpler. Can you talk about the freedoms, the rights, the sort of things that surprised you learning about how women lived in 1789 in early America?
People always ask me, if you could go back in time, what era would you live in? And I say, none of them. History was awful for women, really, prior to about 1900. In particular, in America in the 1700s, what we know as our legal rights in general, not even just as women, were bare bones. The court system barely existed. We were talking about this backstage. We'd had a constitution for 2 years. The Bill of Rights had not been written. In the Constitution, we had the first 5 articles. Most of what we know as due process, most of the rights that we take for granted, do not even think about, did not exist, particularly for women. And one of the things that I discovered early when writing this book is during Martha's time, women could not testify in court without the presence of their husbands or their fathers, with one exception. If you were a midwife, you were granted legal status that would let you come in and testify in court, because one of the laws that had been written early on, I want to say it was in the 1500s, do not quote me. The hard drive has been halfway deleted because I'm working on a new book. But this law was called a law for the punishment of fornication and the maintenance of bastard children. And it was a law on the books in Massachusetts at the time. And it basically said if a woman had a child outside of wedlock, she'd have to go to the court and either pay a fine, possibly spend a night in jail. The man had no requirements. There was no fee. There was no jail time. There was no nothing. But for a midwife, one of the things that they were required to do if they delivered a child that was born out of wedlock was ask the mother the name of the father. And this is the part that is kind of hilarious to me. The people who wrote the law genuinely believed that women were not capable of lying in childbirth. I'd have lied to you just for talking to me. Clearly they knew nothing about women and less about childbirth, but Martha was required by law to inquire of the name. Sometimes they told her the name, sometimes they didn't. She would have to go to court and declare the mother said this, or the mother refused. This book takes place 50 years post-Puritan era, and we tend to think of the Puritans as really pure. Not so much.
Yes, there's so much extramarital, premarital sex in this book. Like, was that how it was?
Fascinating tidbit for you. In Martha's time, based on her diary, based on the children that she delivered, 4 in 10 first pregnancies were conceived out of wedlock. 1 to 2 in 10 were born outside of wedlock, so you had a lot of shotgun weddings, and you had a lot of 9-pound premature children. Gosh, biology works, man. It has worked from the dawn of time, and I loved that Martha approached this reality with a very, very dispassionate view and absolutely no judgment. And I thought, gosh, we have sanitized so much of human history. And we tend to think if it happened back then, they must have been really proper about it. No.
Yeah.
As Shakespeare says, the world must be peopled.
While you were writing this, though, I mean, the conversation was really shifting in the country about reproductive rights, women's rights. The Dobbs decision came down in June of 2022, for instance. And, you know, women's reproductive rights, how we talk about things like extramarital sex, premarital sex, is really shifting during this time. Were you informed by some of that when you were writing this book?
That is a great question. So two things can be true. I was editing the book about the time of the Dobbs decision, which clearly was front of mind for the entire country. But also, one of my jobs when I approach any moment in history is to try to separate the modern era in which I live, because I learned early on, history does not need me to editorialize it. Mm-hmm. And so to look at this story, I had to really focus every day to sit down and go, okay, Martha Ballard could not imagine the world that we live in. Martha Ballard could not imagine going and voting. She couldn't imagine most of the things that women today enjoy. So if that was her reality, what is she focused on? If she's living at a moment when these things don't exist, what is her focus? How does she view the world? And that is the thing that I worked really hard to build in. And in doing that, it became a story that you could read in the newspaper. Honestly, you could open any newspaper in the country today and read something similar. But because it's set several hundred years in the past, there's this level of separation that allows you to look at it in a way that you cannot if you're reading a modern story. History changes, but it doesn't.
Speaking of that, you know, a central spine of your story is this very brutal sexual assault, which gets adjudicated through a complicated process in the book. What was it like reading about that in Martha's diary, and how did you approach writing this part of the story?
So in Martha's diary, if you've read the book, this might shock you, but in Martha's diary, it was worse. There were three men, and it happened three separate times over the course of a week. So what is portrayed as one very awful night was a series of horrific assaults on this poor woman. And I couldn't write it. I couldn't do it. I didn't want to spend time there, and I didn't want to do that to you. One of the most difficult parts of my job is to go, okay, how do I write a hard thing in such a way that you feel all of the horror of what has happened without making it gratuitous, without making you so appalled and uncomfortable that you have to close the book? Like, there's this really fine line, and it can never, ever, ever, ever be entertainment. And I didn't want it to be. So my approach there is that it has to happen off screen. I didn't want the actual assault to be there, but I also needed you to understand what happened. So I have this poor woman have to stand up in court in front of an all-male set of judges and her friends and her family in her town and say what happened. And because the story is written from Martha's point of view, I was able to kind of shift back and forth. Rebecca Foster is talking, and then Martha will give commentary or insight. Because in real life, Martha Ballard was the person that treated Rebecca Foster after this happened. And the details of that assault and the ensuing trial are recorded in her diary. To this day, they are the only written record that we have of what happened. The verdict is still written. She was the only person to bother to write down the details. So I needed it to be kind of from Martha's point of view. I needed it to be really intense and hard to read, but without pushing it to the point where you close the book.
Was one of the men really a judge?
Yes.
Wow.
And what do you do? What do you do if the person you accuse is the town judge? It's horrible in every way. And so there's a second conflict that is set up. The judge that Martha has to go to give testimony of all these childbirths is the judge that is accused in this story. They know each other. And you have this extra layer of conflict.
There's a Black character in your book, a traveling medical provider that you call Doctor. Can you talk about this character and the real person that she was based on?
Again, you're not going to read Martha's diary. If you did, you would find a very small handful of references to a Black female doctor that would occasionally come to Hallowell, Maine. And what's fascinating, other than she uses Black female and doctor, she doesn't say nurse, she doesn't say midwife, she uses the phrase physician. is that when this woman would come to Hallowell, Martha's friends and neighbors skipped over her medical care and went to this other woman.
Hmm.
I do not think it is a stretch to say that means that she had superior medical skills to Martha. What is fascinating, however, is that this woman's name is never recorded in Martha's diary. But at the time, there were 12 free black families living in Hallowell. Massachusetts was the first state to abolish slavery. And at the time, there were 12 families in this town that Martha knew. She worked with, she delivered their babies, she bartered and traded and talked to them. She knew their names and recorded them in her diary, with one exception, this female physician. And it made me think, does she not know it, or does she purposefully not record it? And so she is one of the characters that I loved most because, again, this is the story of our world. Women so often get written out of history.
Yeah.
But Martha made sure that there was a mention of her.
Thanks for joining us today for a conversation between Ariel Lahan and NHPR's Rebecca Lavoy. Coming up, Ariel and Rebecca discuss what a film version of the Frozen River could look like. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on a New England Stage. We're hearing today from NHPR's Director of On-Demand Audio, Rebecca Lavoy, and author Ariel Lahan, recorded in front of a live audience in November 2024.
You talked about this being a time when the Constitution was 2 years old, yet there's a legal procedural at the center of your book, too. In addition to the mystery, we also have this like law and order situation in court. What did you learn about that process when you were researching the going to court, like the laws, how it worked?
It was bonkers. The whole thing was nuts. I mean, imagine. So there were three levels, right? There's the petty level. Your neighbor steals your cow, or your neighbor curses on the Sabbath and you want to lodge a complaint. So the lowest level is petty complaints. Somebody didn't pay a bill. Somebody punched you in the nose, kind of thing. The next is more serious. It is theft. It is murder. It is rape. It is assault. And then the higher level was appeals court, so to say. They would handle any issues that couldn't get resolved in the lower courts. And then you had the Supreme Court. And it was really fascinating for me to approach this from a modern mindset where we think of due process. We think of rights. We think there are things that are established and you are innocent until proven guilty, and you're given a lawyer if you can't afford one, and you're read your Miranda rights. Bupkis, none of it. Didn't exist. Most of the time, if a woman was assaulted, her daddy, her husband, her brothers were going to take care of it before it could ever get to the courts. And so you've got this kind of freewheeling vengeance aside that was happening over here, and then you've got a baby country trying to establish the rules by which we live civilly. And those two things are constantly in conflict throughout the story.
I actually listened to this book. I didn't read it. How do you go about crafting the audio version of your book? How much involvement do you have? Do you choose the reader?
So I do not read them. I do not have that skill. I've read my author's notes in a couple of my books. And the producer always says, "You're very lippy." And I don't know what being lippy means, but it's apparently not good if you're in a sound booth. For all of my other books, I have been sent a list of narrators and links to Audible. And the producer will say, "We have so-and-so in mind. Go listen to them. Here are three options. Tell me who you like best. We'll try to schedule them." With this book, however, the producer did auditions. And she sent the first chapter of the book to five different narrators and then sent me audio recordings of them, which was weird, because you don't know if somebody's right until they're reading your words. And I'd always heard them read other people's books, and so I was listening to different things. But when they read your book, you go, "Ah, I don't like that pronunciation," or "No, absolutely not." And then I got to the fourth person on the list, and her name was Jane Oppenheimer, and I went, "Oh, there you are." And what it was for me is I grew up with a mother who read to me. And there's a difference between acting and reading. And my mother was a reader, and she's got this really beautiful reading voice. And it has taken me most of my life to be comfortable with audiobooks because nobody sounds like my mother. But in so many ways, I modeled Martha Ballard after my own mother. She looks like my mom. Mm. They've got this kind of taciturn, quiet strength. With Martha Ballard, you have to earn it. With my mother, you have to earn it. And I heard Jane Oppenheimer and I went, oh, there you are. And so I chose her and she did the book and it was great. And she did a phenomenal job.
Backstage, you told me that every book that you're creating is a jigsaw puzzle. What do you mean by that?
So I can never read my books the way that you read them. My relationship to these books is entirely different. The biggest lie they ever tell authors is, write the book you want to read. Plot twist, you can't read that thing. I can, to this day, flip open to any page of any of my books and go, oh, I remember writing that. I was at Panera, and I spent $8 on lunch. My association is so different. I know who done it. I know how the rabbit was smuggled into the hat. I know where all the red herrings are. I can't ever read these books. To me, my relationship is I am building a puzzle. I love jigsaw puzzles. I buy these wooden ones every year at Christmas, and they're not, the shapes are not normal. They're wackadoo. It takes forever to put it together, and I love it. But for me, I approach a book the way that I approach a puzzle, in that the first thing you do is you just dump it all out on the table. I am blah. It is this mental vomit of ideas and names and characters and dates and places. But then I flip over all the pieces, right? You're trying to see what you have to work with. And then I find the corners. And then I find all the edges. And so I build it kind of from the outside in. And over the course of many, many months, I'm working my way in. I'm finding the patterns. I'm looking for the pictures. I'm putting them where they belong. I'm like, oh, I've been looking for that piece for 6 months. Didn't know that went here. And it's this really, really fun process of discovery. If you were to steal my laptop and look at the book that I am working on now, you would be like, what is happening? This is nonsense. But I'm halfway through the puzzle. It's going to be nonsense for a long time. So eventually I'll finish, and then eventually it will be a book that exists that I cannot read. So I get to come here and I get to talk to you, and that is the full circle moment for me. That is when it becomes real. Because when the book goes out in the world, it is no longer mine. It does not belong to me. It is yours. It is about the relationship you have with it. What means something to you? What made you laugh? What made you cry? What you underlined? It becomes yours.
An audience member wants to know, have you ever visited a setting or location from one of your books and been disappointed that it didn't live up to your imagination?
So I've never really visited a location, but something fun has happened. With every single book that I have written, I have been contacted after the publication by somebody that has a relationship with the book. With my first novel, it's called The Wife, the Maid, and the Mistress, is about a missing judge. I got an email from a woman and she goes, Mrs. Lahan, would love to know where you did the research for your novel. The showgirl in your novel was my grandmother. I was like, oh God, I did that to somebody's grandmother. With my second novel, I got to talk to a little tiny, tiny, tiny old German man whose father had taken him on a tour of the Hindenburg prior to its last flight. And he's like, you got it right. My third novel is set during the Russian Revolution, and it's about Anastasia Romanov and the woman who is believed to be her most famous imposter. And I got an email from a woman at the University of Virginia. She did genetic research. And she told me that she'd read the novel, that she loved it. And she's like, I just want you to know I was the person that did the genetic research to determine whether or not Anastasia Romanov did survive the Russian Revolution.
Wow.
And she proceeds to tell me how she was walking across the campus that day, being the only person in the world who knew at that moment whether she had or hadn't.
Another question, I love this one. If this book became a movie, who would you like to play Martha and Ephraim?
Okay, so this is hilarious.
I know you've thought about this, right?
I actually haven't. So most of my writer, well, I have now. Most of my writer friends, they can close their eyes and they can see their characters and they hear them. And it's this really interactive process when they write. That does not happen for me. All of my people are invisible and mute. I see nothing, I hear nothing. And because of that, I never have, other than my mom in this case, like the physicality of Martha, I modeled after my mom. So I had nobody in mind until I was watching The Wheel of Time with my youngest son, and I saw Rosamund Pike. I was like, oh, she says a lot with her face.
Oh, yeah.
I think she would make a great Martha.
She knows how to be taciturn, too. If you've ever seen Gone Girl, she can do that.
Terrifying.
Exactly. Another question. I love the character of the fox and would love to know your inspiration for that.
Tempest. Here's another date that I can say with absolute certainty. June 19th, 2018. My husband and I were woken up by a sound that I can only describe as your most dearly beloved being slaughtered in their sleep. We do not wake up and run through the house. We wake up, he runs to the house. I stayed in bed because I'm not stupid. Just to check on the kids. Nobody's dead. Everybody's fine. We proceed to find this fox on our back deck, and it is barking. If you've never heard a fox bark, it will make your butt pucker. It is terrifying. Go to YouTube, just search it. And it was just this alarming moment. We go back to bed. But several hours later, we wake up to the news that a child had been born into our family under very fragile circumstances, into our extended family. And if you've read the novel, you should probably be able to recognize what child I'm talking about. And those two things became woven together in my mind, the fox and the baby and the fox and the baby. And I had no intention of putting either of them in the book, but I was just beginning the process of writing this novel and thinking about it. And to me, that is one of the best parts about my job, because there are these surprises that spring from my actual life that I cannot plan, I cannot research, I cannot plot. They just work their way in because I, too, am a real person living in the world. Funnest moment of this book tour, this book publication for me, actually was that in the spring, I got to take a short break from my book tour and come home and watch that baby be adopted. And to me, they're just, they are one and the same, the fox and the baby.
Another audience question. Did the Ballards really know Paul Revere?
That was a little fictional bit that people ask me about a lot, and it was just fun. It was just fun. I had, unrelated to the plotting of this book, stumbled across pictures of Revere Pewter, and he signed it all. And then later on, I was researching the book, and I realized that part of what she would do is she would mix her ink in small pewter dishes, and I thought, why not?
I mean, New England's a small place, right? We know each other.
We can't prove they didn't.
One of the things I love about your website, and I've never seen this on an author website before, this specifically, is you show the room where you write, and you actually give a tour of different elements of the room. What interests you about the spaces in which people write?
I cannot prove this. I don't even know how you would do a scientific study. But I think where a book is written informs the book itself. For me, that is a room in my house that used to be a dining room that my husband closed off and turned into an office. And it's got this old desk. A number of years ago, he bought me this. It's tiny. It's not much bigger than this. It is a teacher's desk that was pulled out of an old one-room schoolhouse. And it's got all the stains and chips and nicks. And I love to sit there and think, what stories were told at this desk? Who taught here?
You've written about all these different eras, World War II, you've written about the Romanovs, Russian Revolution. Is there a time that you are just dying to write about that you are searching for a story to fit?
Ooh, yes and no. So my next one is set during medieval Ireland, which if you think 1700s Maine is hard to write about, geez. Also, I didn't think before I decided to write about a pirate, the fact that I get seasick.
Yeah.
That's turning out to be a bit of a problem. So that is the next book. Actually, the one that I'm waiting for, the dream book for me, and I have most of it built in my head, is actually a Western.
You used to be involved with a digital book club for women. I belong to a book club. I had such a hard time. It feels like so much pressure, like choosing the book for everybody to read. These are my friends, right? How do you recommend books to complete strangers on the internet? How do you choose a book to tell somebody to read?
If I've loved it, I can recommend it. That site that we have since retired, it was called She Reads, and it was a friend and I, we did it, and we would talk in real life, and we would share book recommendations, and we realized that separately, our friends would come over, and they'd wander in, and you go to your friend's bookshelf, right? That's what you do if your friends are readers, and they would say, what should I read next? What's good? And we'd be like, oh, Water for Elephants, Kite Runner, like fill in the blanks. And then we thought, well, we're doing this anyway. We could just take it online. And we did for about 10 years. And we ran this really, really fun online book club. And then we both ended up becoming novelists professionally. And we're like, we have no time left. So we eventually retired it, but it was really, really gratifying to be able to say, oh, here's a book that I loved. You should read this also. And I still do that on my own blog. Like I did that recently with I Cheerfully Refuse by Leif Anger. I love his books. And so whenever I find a book that just knocks my socks off, I still do it. You have to read this. And I'll share it because it's fun. And to this day, I believe that word of mouth is still the best way to get word out about books. We can market, we can publicize, we can do all of the things. But when a friend of mine says, I love this book, you have to read it, we have to talk about it when you're done, I'm going to read it. 100% of the time, I'm going to read it.
You know, an editor will often tell a writer, and I've gotten this myself from editors, you got to kill your darlings to make your book better, right? Did you learn things about Martha or about Halliwell Maine or about any of these people that it just killed you to not include in this book?
This is the saddest part of this book for me. The book begins with the fox. If you've read the book, you know that we have the fox at the beginning and the fox at the end. And there are six sections in the book. Originally, there were four more. I call them animal scenes, for lack of a better word. And they were the different animals in the book. There was one that kind of featured that really horrible coyote. There was the dog. There was the peregrine falcon. And there was a rabbit that was since cut from the book entirely. And they weren't from the animal's point of view, but it features her. And I loved them. I loved them so much. And nobody else did. My agent said, they're so pretty, but I don't know what they mean. And my editor said, no.
Yeah. Of course, there is the Pulitzer Prize winning book about Martha Ballard, but she doesn't appear and women like her don't appear in any of our history textbooks when we go to school. You know, it's the founding fathers. It's very much from the perspective of the men of the time. How do you think our understanding of American history would shift if the Martha Ballards of that time were just as present in our textbooks?
It would be revolutionary. If you think about it, when it comes to big conflicts, history is written by the winners. The losers never get to tell their version. But history is also written by those who were educated, who had the access to books, reading, writing. And throughout so much of history, women were in the sidelines. But I always say, if you want to know what really happened at any moment in history, go talk to the women who lived it. Find their records if you can, because they record totally different things. Men are obsessed with the wars and the bullets and the bombs. Not all of them. That's a gross generalization. But men do this. Women do this. And they focus on the people and the relationships and what they have lost and the small betrayals and what it cost them at any moment in history. And the fact is, we need both. We need the big and we need the small, and we've lost so much of it. It's why I do what I do, and I could live 100 years and never write enough books to really scratch the surface of the lives of women we have forgotten, but I am trying.
Ariel Lahan, I will read anything that you write after reading this book. Thank you so much again.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to Writers on a New England Stage, a partnership between the Music Hall in Portsmouth and NHPR. Our host for the evening was Rebecca Lavoy. The Music Hall's executive director is Tina Sautel. NHPR's president and CEO is Jim Schachter. NHPR's producer for Writers on a New England Stage is Sarah Plord. NHPR's event producer is Zoe Kay. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. NHPR's production manager is me, Dan Cahill. The Music Hall's production manager is Jana Morris. Music Hall live sound and recording engineer is Ian Martin. Musical director and band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. And the Music Hall literary producer is Brittany Wasson. If you missed any part of this show, go to nhpr.org/writers and download the Writers on a New England Stage podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. This is NHPR.